For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygen's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
Good evening, everyone. So I'm very happy tonight to have Steve Tibbs giving our talk. Steve is a longtime Zen practitioner for a while now at Ancient Dragon Zen Gate. Steve is on our board's fundraising committee and budget committee, so there are many ways to help out here at Ancient Dragon. So, Steve, thank you very much for agreeing to give the talk, and
thank you.
Take it away.
I want to thank Tygen and the Sangha. I'm very, very grateful for being able to do this. I've been practicing for about 13 years now. I began in 2000. And it's roughly, actually, I started in February of 2000, so we're hitting almost the exact 13-year mark. So maybe for all of you, this is the lucky 13 as it is for me. I want to go into the history a little bit. This is sort of a entering the way talk for me. How I sort of entered it and sort of the observations of the last 13 years. Going into it, I started at the Zen Center in Los Angeles again in February of 2000. My teacher was Roshi Gyoku Nakao, a Japanese-American woman, successor of Bernie Glassman, Roshi Bernie Glassman, and also Mizumi Roshi. She practiced with Mizumi Roshi for years. So I practiced at ZCLA for about 3.5 years, and then my job transferred me to London in September of 2003. And Roshi Gyoku recommended a sangha in Paris called Dana Sangha with a successor of Genpo Roshi, who was also a Mizumi Roshi student. Her name was Katrine Page. It was an interesting time because I learned to do chants in French at the time, which don't ask me to ever do that now. But at the time I could do it. I took about a year to learn that. It was interesting because they were, even though it was a French song and all the talks, most of the talks were in French, there were students from all over the place. There were students from Holland and England, Belgium, Poland. During that time, I had a very solitary practice after 3.5 years of fairly close practice with Roshi Gyoku at the time at Zen Center of LA. I was really worried going into that because I wasn't sure if I could do it. But I did. I would sit every day for about an hour. London had a sitting group. Even though there were no white plum teachers in London or in England, they had a sitting group there. About once a month, they would have an all-day sit, and I used to go there. Gradually, I got to be pretty close with the person that led the sitting group, who was also a Genpo Roshi student. So we actually began to set up a weekly practice there. So it was really a nice time. Again, I practiced in Paris for about a year. They had a sesshin almost every month, but if you couldn't make the sesshin as an outsider, you couldn't really go. There were no weekend practices or anything other than the sesshins. So I found it difficult after the practice I had earlier. I want to kind of comment on that. One of the things that I found after leaving my teacher, I felt very close to, you could probably tell, the classic story of Dharma rain, that you're in this little mist and you're receiving all these words, and you really don't, at least I didn't really notice it at all. I can tell you, during my time in Europe, I don't think I ever had a day where I didn't think about her or something didn't pop in my mind about her or something that she said. And I didn't really realize the impact. There was one summer where I was going to go about 4 months without practicing. So I went to Holland, a place just outside of Groningen in the north of Holland, where they also had another white plum teacher and another successor of Genpo Roshi. It was Tenke Roshi. He was a Dutch teacher who had lived in the United States for 12 years, and he was married to a British woman, and his English was perfect, and in fact, he had students from Germany and Spain and other countries as well, but everything was in English, so it was kind of a pleasure. I gave up the French for that. But it was a much more conservative practice. Roshi Gyoku was very influenced by the social dharma from Bernie Glassman, as was Dana Zendo in Paris. They used to pass out food every Sunday night at Le Gardien Nord, which was an interesting thing. Talk about that another time. But after that, I moved to Chicago. And actually, I met Tigan when I first moved here. I sat at the... I forget the name of the place.
The Senegal.
Senegal.
Retreat Center.
Yeah, I sat a few times
Some
there.
Of you, how many people here remember the Senegal? Nathan and Jim and Don. Oh, Bill was there once, yeah.
Yeah, I was... I lived in Oak Park, and also Oak Park had a white plum teacher. So I was... I learned to be very loyal to the lineage. And so I sat there for about 3 years. And... euphemistically, I'll say then I took a break. I had about 2 years where I did different things. I never stopped sitting. I sat at home almost every night. It may not have just been intense. If I felt like stopping after 20 minutes, I did. But it was a good time for practice. That's the little history there. I wanted to kind of go a little bit into a koan that stayed with me very much during that time. Sometimes I find that what strikes one in practice isn't what you think at the time, it's what comes out later, and what stays in your mind or pops at a different time. This one's always been good for me. It's case two of the Blue Cliff record. Chacho said to the assembly, "The ultimate pass is without difficulty. Just avoid picking and choosing. As soon as there are words spoken, this is picking and choosing. This old monk does not abide within clarity. Do you preserve anything or not?" A monk asks, "Since you do not abide in clarity, what do you preserve?" Chachu replied, "I don't know either." The monk said, "Since you don't know, teacher, why do you nonetheless say that you do not abide within clarity?" Chachu said, "Is enough to ask about the matter. Bow and withdraw." So if anyone's ever done koan practice before, that's basically when they ring the bell and you get out. But I just thought it was an interesting one because he talks about avoiding picking and choosing. And my Zen practice has been very traveled. I've had 5 teachers in 13 years and lived in other spots. And to some extent, I picked, I would pick some situations. I didn't choose to leave Europe, but I did choose to come to Ancient Dragon. So what does that picking and choosing really mean? In reality, just the whole nature of this life is picking and choosing. You couldn't survive even in the wilderness if you didn't make choices. So I work in business, in my profession. I'd be out the door. Would never have gotten in the door if I didn't pick and choose. So there's something about life that we have to make choices, and yet Chachu says the great way is not to pick and choose. That's why I always love this koan. I think you can always go deeper into that one. And then just in terms of something from practice too, from Dogen, I remember a talk once at UCLA, and I'm going to paraphrase it. Tigan speaks about it sometimes, but how this practice is really just the very act of sitting here tonight or coming to a zendo is practice enlightenment. We get to the cushion, we sit, we practice, we realize something whether we know it or not. I know I'd like fireworks to go off out more often, but it doesn't. But actually, the very first time we sit on our cushions really is practice, realization, and a form of enlightenment. And it's continuous. So how does that work with picking and choosing? What time in here? Sorry, okay.
Keep going.
When I was 25 years old, it's back in 1978, we didn't have the internet, we didn't have all the Dharma books. I don't think I'd ever seen Suzuki Roshi's book. I don't know if I'd ever heard of Suzuki Roshi. I didn't know. You couldn't have, if someone stuck a gun to my head, I couldn't name a Zen teacher. But I did know about Alan Watts. I was living in Venice, California at the time. And I had read about D.T. Suzuki. And there was a period where I got very motivated by that. And I was running on the beach, and then I'd sit for 5 minutes. I had no idea about the breathing, had no idea about posture. But I wanted to sit. I wanted to get enlightened. That's the reality. So actually I worked in downtown Los Angeles, and I worked near the Zen Center of LA. And so I think it was one evening I left work, and I was just determined to go to the Zen Center of Los Angeles and work on getting enlightened. So I drove to the center, got out of the car. There was this old house with sort of a steel fence, and with a gate, and I couldn't walk in. I stayed there for about 10 minutes and wanted to go in, and I couldn't do it. So I went back home and ran on the beach and sat for 5 minutes, and over the years, every once in a while, I'd sit for 5 minutes and stop running on the beach, obviously. It just went. And I want to get to one last point before a little more pedantry here. One last thing. When I was in England, I read a book called Points of Departure by Ito Roshi. And he had something that has always meant a lot to me. He talks about the readiness of time. There's a key concept for which he used the phrase the readiness of time, that when something will happen, we don't know when it'll happen or what will happen, but it will happen in the readiness of time. So kind of going on from there about, I guess about 20-some years plus, in the year 2000, I was actually pretty happy. I had a good job, married, still am married, still have a decent job. But for some reason, I just had that same drive that was striking me when I was 25. And I was 47 by then. The nice thing about being 47 is you know that if you don't do something, you never will. So I decided to go back to the gate. And I walked in. And it was very weird. I know Ken used to go there. It wasn't what I expected, you know, a bunch of bald men in robes, people in these funny bibs. But I did go through a practice session where they taught us how to sit. So I learned to breathe and learned to sit. I was using Seiza in those days rather than a chair. And right after that, we had a Dharma talk from Roshi Gyoku, which still holds to me today. I remember it vividly. You know, she walked in, she was average height, Japanese American woman, wearing a black robe, and I was blown away. She was really funny, and the funny thing is, she's talking about death. And she had me just in stitches, which ordinarily doesn't happen. But she talked about the four Dharma seals. That was the first talk I ever heard. Impermanence. And I remember vividly she said something like, we're all going to die. Everything that's here is going to die. The buildings are going to go away. The stars are going to go away. And I was just mesmerized. And then she talked about dukkha and the concept of no self. And liberation. And what struck me, and she pointed it out, and it's funny because I had a dream last night about this, and I realized that I'm still living this, I'm still learning this lesson, but that the very impermanence that we have, this very sense that we all do have, you know, a limited time in this situation, if you would call it that, is really our liberation. that's what frees us. That's what allows us to get unstuck. And so, right after that, I mean, a lot of things happened. My Zen practice, obviously, I moved around. I lived in Los Angeles for a long time when I went to ZCLA, and suddenly I'm moving around the world. But I really didn't have fear from it. I realized that life was impermanent. I think, unfortunately, my wife didn't either. She was always an Anglophile. But after that talk, I bought a Zapaton and a Seiza bench, and I was in a sesshin a couple weeks later. My knees were killing me. I'm amazed, you know. In Zen Center of Los Angeles, when you moved, they would say, stop moving, or if you breathe too fast, it's breathe quietly. But they let me get away with it, so they didn't do that to me. They did it later, but not that day. So in terms of picking and choosing, suddenly I was sort of at a stalemate with my job. They had, the company I was with had been sold, and I had a chance to go to the UK. And I spoke to Roshi Ogyoku about that because, you know, I'm going to give up something. And I chose to leave, but she actually did refer me over to the Sangha in Paris. And it was a Genpo Roshi Sangha. It was the Kanzian Sangha, which has had its own controversies the last few years. But I was very, very attached to the students there. Really incredible time. Really fascinating people, as we kind of got past our language barriers at times. And then when I came back, I stopped for a while. And it's not unusual. It's something that's, I don't know how many of you have ever been that way, but a lot of, I know Roshi Ogyoku and Stockton a couple of years. I met a teacher at Zen Center in Los Angeles that was practicing seriously and stopped for about 20 years. And I never thought that would happen to me, but it did. And so I'll kind of end with what drove me back. Because I was sitting, you know, every day. But what drove me back really was there was a song, a problem at Kanzion Sangha with Genpo Roshi. And for some reason, I just felt the pain that those people had. They were all, he was a very charismatic teacher, and a lot of people were really attached to him. So I felt just as, I think in reality, it was just sort of a feeling of Sangha that I had a responsibility to sit, not necessarily for myself, but for the people I practiced with. And about 2 years ago, I came here. So that's sort of it. That's that was a time where I really did pick. So, or maybe not. But anyway, that's it.
Thank you very much, Steve.
Thank you.
I appreciated hearing your story. And actually, all the teachers you mentioned I know, or the Zen River place in Holland, I was just there speaking in December. And yeah, would you say again that the story about Zhaozhou and not abiding in clarity?
Sure.
It's a wonderful story. Would you just say it again?
Yeah, I was trying to, I took it a little bit fast because I'm not sure how long it would go. Zhaozhou said to the, it's from the Blue Cliff record, and Zhaozhou, or Joshi in Japanese, said to the assembly, "The ultimate pass is without difficulty. Just avoid picking and choosing. As soon as there are words spoken, this is picking and choosing. This old monk does not abide within clarity. Do you preserve anything or not?" A monk asks, "Since you do not abide in clarity, what do you preserve?" And then Zhaozhou replied, "I don't know either." And the monk said, "Since you don't know, teacher, why do you nonetheless say you do not abide within clarity?" And Zhaozhou said, "It's enough to ask about the matter. Bow and withdraw." And it's interesting because one of the things that I learned in my early years of practice, there was a big concept with not knowing. There's a koan that says not knowing is most intimate. And and yet we do know something. We do pick. But I think part of practice, and when we sit on a cushion, has to be, if we know everything, or whatever you know when you're on a cushion, we're really sort of short-selling ourselves when we get that. And it's the openness that Joju showed is really incredible. I did the koan in a Rinzai fashion, and you know the answer is that you do pick and choose. And yet, Joju said not to pick and choose. So that's the...
Well, and I'll add just that, you know, it goes back to the third ancestor, or a poem attributed to the third ancestor, which talks about not picking and choosing. But the part of, there's a lot of different parts of that story, but the thing about not abiding in clarity, you know, I think we have a, you know, some urge to want to be clear about things. To not abide in clarity is pretty good advice. To not try and hold on to being clear about things, to be willing to be in a fog and still be there, you know. I'm reading this wonderful book, speaking of Bernie Glassman, called The Dude and the Zen Master by Bernie Glassman and Jeff Bridges. It's a wonderful book. I highly recommend it. I'm probably going to looking forward to trying to do a Dharma talk based on it at some point soon. But yeah, the dude abides, and yet also sometimes the dude's not in. So anyway, just that story I wanted to say something about, because it's pretty subtle. But anyway, excuse me for picking up on that and choosing. I wanted to open it up. Comments, responses, questions for Steve about anything. Jeremy.
Thank you so much for talking. I love the imagery of you standing at the gate at 20 and then coming back at 47. It's beautiful.
Nothing.
Reminds me of, I talked to a student today and he told me that his father didn't think he'd amount to anything in his entire life. The kid's 16.
And, wow.
I didn't get a chance to say it, hopefully I get a chance to say it later, but he said that he wrote his father off, and I almost want to say to him, like, don't, you know, give it some time, see if you want to come back later. It's a sticky thing to say, but maybe you'll feel something differently. And it's just amazing imagery, thank you.
Well, thank you. We don't know what's going to happen when we get to the gate, or when we get to the door in this case. I was mentioning this to Aisha a little bit, and I think she said it took her about 10 years from the point that she started thinking about it to the point that she went in. I don't know if that's true for everyone, but some of us are slower than others. Anyone else?
Bill.
Thank you for the talk.
Thank you.
I like that expression, social dharma. I'd like to learn more about how that developed. And of course, from my own Christian background, I know the idea of the social gospel, and it's interesting in that context. But I wanted to raise, from your own experience, to me, one interesting thing about Buddhism is that even though some people come to it from some difficult transformation in their lives, some difficult transitional period or something, it doesn't seem like a crisis religion, so to speak, in the way that Christianity quite often is, where it's a kind of a port in a storm. And personally, it appeals to me in that way too, that in the sense that it doesn't simply offer a kind of placation or for that. I wondered if your own experience, because it seems like when you came back to it, it wasn't simply as a reaction to something.
No, I was very happy. I know that, I don't know if that pisses you off, but I didn't have something where I missed it, inexorably. And it was the same thing when I went in. I was in a very good time in my life. But I can also say that there are times when I've had a crisis that I have sat, and it has been a solace. I know that on 9/11, I was working with a company that was in the World Trade Center, and I was in Seattle. And for a couple hours, I didn't know if all my coworkers were dead. And I sat. That was my reaction. I sat for a couple hours. It was a rather tearful sit, but it was a sit nonetheless. That was my reaction. So there is solace from it. I think it works both ways. Thank you.
Just in response to Bill, I think it's very individual. I think probably everybody here has their own version and their own story. Myself, when I had my first formal Zazen instruction, it totally clicked right away. It was it, you know. And it was at a time in my life when I was doing very well, was successful in my work, and was happily married, and everything was going very, very well. 10 years before, I was deeply questioning everything, you know. But I think it's very individual. I wanted to ask Ken, because I know you've had extensive experience in the White Plum tradition. I don't know if you had any comments or anything to ask or say or to add.
Well, I was going to... first of all, I did... You know, Bernie Glassman and Jeff Bridges were on Charlie Rose, and they've been really working all the venues in terms of publicizing their book. So
it's a great book.
Really? Is that right? Yeah, I didn't see the great Grabowski and...
Big Lebowski, yeah.
Yeah.
One of the all-time great movies.
Is that
where the character comes from, like the dude.
Yeah, it's one of my two favorites in movies, along with Men in Black.
Oh, really? Yeah. I was going to ask Steve if the, practicing as a Zen practitioner and in the midst of a corporate culture, you know, can you... You know, you mentioned your reaction on 9/11 and everything. Is there anything else you can, anything that's developed or emerged over time in terms of your working relationship?
One of the things that I learned early on, because when I, twitching into my days in Los Angeles, I was more open about it. If you want to get gossiped about, talk about Zen practice and corporation. That's a good way to make people think that you're the dude or something. So I don't talk about it. And I remember about 2 or 3 years ago, I had someone on the phone who was from California. And I know he spoke to somebody because he asked me, well, you're not a Buddhist, are you, or anything like that? And I said, I'm a heathen. Yeah. I don't think it's a smart thing to advertise, depending on, in some places it might be fine.
Right, but then how about an impact on yourself personally? Anything that has your practice changed your attitude towards corporate work, that kind of thing?
That's a hard one. Because I got into it later in life, I always knew that I was going to retire from it, so I had a finite end to it. And so maybe I'm more hopeful of retiring because of that. I know that... I remember one time... I worked in a fairly highly stressed situation. Not as much now, but for a number of years I did. And... when you work in corporations, oftentimes they have bullies. So I was working for a bully at the time. And the only way to really... And so I violated every precept that you could go through that, because it's hard to stay calm with that situation. And I remember I was in a situation where I had to get something done, and this person was yelling at me. You remember me over at the Old Fazendo. I would go there every morning and sit for an hour. I just sat for an hour. And suddenly when I got out and went to the yell, I'm on the cell phone and my boss is yelling at me. Yeah. And so I'm yelling back at him after I just sat. And I hang up, and then I was calm again. it was just that moment. So that's probably the most obvious situation of sitting and having it help in the practice, because I was able to be angry in the moment and let it go.
I like the talk. That was good to hear the history.
Thank you.
For 13 years. You talked about moving and that you weren't so maybe fearful about the moving, but, you know, for me, I'm always fearful of the move and just not knowing and that. I think it's helpful to me thinking about hopefully moving to a place that has, you know, some kind of Buddhist, you know, place I consider some place to go sit, you know, and that may be that Taigen knows the teacher and, you know, that I can do that, because I think then there's that, you know, that fellowship or, you know, whatever that is of Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
So did you feel that then?
Like, oh, yeah.
Knowing that your teacher from UCLA or...
CCLA.
Right,
yeah.
Sun
Center of Los Angeles.
Then over, you know, across the ocean, you know, but having that, you know, and then even when you moved then into Holland and then back, I mean, just to have that connection and kind of like a family, even really, I kind of feel like that.
It really was. Thank you for the question. It's a good question because one of the I shouldn't speak with too much, but I mean, the disadvantage, or I'll reverse it the other way. Zen Center of Los Angeles, their successors tended to leave. They would be at CCLA for X number of years, and once they got Dharma transmission, they would go elsewhere. So Genpo Roshi immediately spent a number of years in Europe. And so there was a whole sangha based on Zen-centered students. And every time somebody would go on vacation, they would, or holiday, as they say, every time someone would go on vacation, they would visit. And so there was, and then they would have these annual meetings of the successors of Mizumi Roshi. And they'd be coming from all over the world, and successors of the successors. A lot of people don't even know some of the successors because, you know, they're 30 times down the line or something. But it was great because everyone knew my teacher. I think it would be a similar situation if you went elsewhere. Everyone would know Taigen. So I wouldn't actually fear that as much as... I mean, I shouldn't say that, but it's better than you think. Than you might think. It's pretty good that way. And it was very comforting because you immediately know someone and you have something in common. In my case, the only difference was that the language was different, but it was the same chance. I could, you know, I bowed at the same time all the time. Everything was the same.
It's one of the interesting things about, you know, this goes way back in Buddhism, actually, the idea of, and the sutras talk about sons and daughters of the Buddha family and sons and daughters of Buddha. And actually, in the West now, and it wasn't true when I started practicing, and maybe even when you started practicing. But now there are there are different families, you know. So the ZCLA family from Izumi Roshi is kind of cousins of San Francisco Zen Center lineage from Suzuki Roshi that I'm part of, that we're part of. But now, and it's true that ZCLA family, they all shot out, you know, as soon as they got transmission, whereas San Francisco Zen Center tended to all kind of hunker down in the Bay Area, or at least California, but now is spreading out. But there's this, there is this extended family, and it's just, you know, I think it's, you know, good that you know that, and that they're... And I was just on the phone for a couple of hours with a teacher in Oregon from Izumi Roshi's lineage earlier today. And actually, you know, there gets to be all this Zen politics, which can be difficult. But I've been communicating with a totally different family of people in Japan. But we're having, you know, I moved here 7 years ago and there weren't any direct Suzuki Roshi heirs in the Midwest. They're the Katagiri Roshi lineage, which is a close relationship to San Francisco Zen Center. We're actually inspired by a couple of other people in the Midwest. There's actually going to be a gathering of Midwestern Zen teachers here in August, about a couple dozen people just getting together for a day to hang out and, you know, just talk together, and We've invited a couple dozen people from a wide, actually quite a range of Zen lineages in Illinois and Iowa and Wisconsin and Indiana and Minnesota. Anyway, so there's a kind of alternate family, and it's anyway. So that's there's that aspect to the Dharma, and you know, part of what Steve's story is about is those connections and the possibility of that. So,
it's interesting. Just as an adjunct to that, is that I'd say if I made a mistake in practice or something that there are no mistakes in practice, but in my own mind. I guess I can disprove that any time it is a sheen. if you can look at it, I mean, I remember sitting at the Cenacle and meeting Tigan for the first time. And I really like Tigan, and I really, really like the San Francisco lineage. I've grown closer that way. Even though I wear this rock suit, and you can probably tell from my talk, there's no one in the world I have more respect for than Roshi Gyoku. Incredible person. I think I was too fixed on lineage. I know I was way too fixed on lineage. And that was where I was abiding in clarity. I knew what I wanted. And I think one of the things I probably, if there's anything I learned in the last 5 years in practice, is that you really have to not abide in clarity, what we used to call it with Roshi Gyoku, the not knowing aspect. And you're not going to know what you have. And to some extent, you have to have faith in practice. It's very important.
Well, I'll add that Gyoku from CCLA and I perform Suisei together at the same time. Suisei is the ceremony at Eheiji and Sojiji, the two headquarter temples in Japan in the Soto school. There were a couple of other people along with us where you are authorized by the Japanese Soto school as a teacher. It's a very formal ceremony. So Gyoku and I kind of were authorized together in Japan. So, you know, all these Dharma interrelationships are very complicated. And Dogen talks about tangled vines, and we're all interconnected in all kinds of ways, and that's so family, you know, they're families of families. And so I appreciate Steve being part of our Sangha now.
Thank you.